Thank you very much. Okay, so my name is David Sexton. I work at the Met Office, and I'm going to be talking about uncertainty and quantification in climate projections that we use to inform climate adaptation. I'd like to thank Ben Sanderson, who's at Cicero in Norway, and Ben Booth, who's my team, for some of the slides that they've shared with me. So I'm going to start off with talking about our national climate projections, just show you what the UK's projections look like. And then I'm going to dig a bit deeper into the climate modelling and the evaluation, how we use that to constrain projections. And then I think I'm going to touch on this kind of thorny issue of model imperfections and show how they're represented in the projections, but also some of the problems and limitations of the way we do it and potential ways forward. So our latest national climate projection, so the UK's projections, were published in 2018. That's 9 years after the predecessor, so there's quite a long time in between them. And this time around, there were more products. There were six products, and I'm going to concentrate on the two at the top, which are the probabilistic projections and the global projections. And the reason we ran them this time is because we've got new scientific capability, but also the users have become more sophisticated, getting more requirements. And essentially, the people we're thinking of when we do climate projections are mainly the people who run impacts models. So we're there to provide information on the weather, and then they take that and put that into their impacts models. So like flood models, crop models, things like that. And so really, we're trying to provide information on weather. It's not climate, as you might think of it, like 30-year averages. What they need to know is the possible range of weather in the future. And that's because weather has the impact. And also, it's because people, it's the thing that people can relate to. And so it's because impacts models take more than one variable often. It's a big multivariate coherent variable problem. We have to provide that information. And the difference with the pandemic is it's kind of nice that we're given these socioeconomic emission scenarios. For example, so this is the PDF of the global warming under a fossil fuel intensive emissions compared with the blue one, which is like a real effective mitigation scenario. So there's no need to interact and feed back onto the emission scenarios. That's not something we're asked to do. So these two types of projections are basically, there's probabilistic ones on the left. So example here are these plumes are made up of the evolution of different percentiles in the probability. So you can see the spread develops over time for the fossil fuel intensive emissions and for these effective mitigation. And so they're good because these are ways, there's lots of statistical post-processing and it's a way to combine uncertainties. Whereas on the right-hand side, it's more, these are the actual individual climate simulations you're seeing here. The orange ones are the ones my team made with the Met Office model. And then the blue ones come from the previous Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's assessment. So in 2014. And we pull these things together to give a range of plausible climates. And so these are what we call plausible realizations, and they tend to be more multivariate. So the weakness on this one is that there's a limited amount of spatially, physically, temporally coherent data because a lot of the statistics kind of limits you in that respect. But in terms of this, we're limited in the sense we don't explore all the combinations of uncertainty. So climate models are, I mean, we saw Tim Palmer talk about it yesterday. Climate models are basically, they represent a range of processes, dynamical thermodynamic processes that are, some of them are resolved at horizontal and vertical resolutions, and some of them are unresolved. Things like cloud microphysics or turbulence at certain scales, or like the holes you get in leaves that they exchange the CO2. And so the global models my team run are about 60 kilometer resolution. So there's hundreds of variables at each of these grid boxes. So there's 140,000 grid boxes in the horizontal and 85 levels. So that's why we need these huge supercomputers to do this. And then for the unresolved processes, we have parameterization schemes to represent those. And we have parameters in them that determine and basically control the strength of those processes. Now, my team run global models, but then some people take the inputs around little boundaries and these models, and then they can run at much higher resolution just for this local region. So if you compare the 25 kilometer model for some sort of really, it was meant to be a really heavy rainfall event. Actually, it's not until you get down to the weather forecasting spatial scales of 1.5 kilometers that you start really getting the kind of detail you need. So the workhorse for all the uncertainty work we do are parameter ensembles. So the first step is to then get your distributions and identify the key parameters. And we talked to the model developers about this, and there's 47 parameters here. Unlike Diana's talk, these have all different sorts of shapes and sizes of probability distributions. that we get, and they cover about seven different aspects of the atmosphere and land. And then for the probabilistic predictions, we use a Bayesian framework. We use a Bayes-linear framework, very similar to the kind of one that Danny was talking about. It's it was developed by Goldstein and Ruggier in 2004, and it's a huge joint probability problem. There are model parameters. There's the historical and future model output that you get from all the runs. There's the true climate, both the past where you want to compare against observations and the future you want to predict. There's the actual observations themselves for the calibration. And then there's this model imperfection. And as Danny showed, we use this best input assumption. So you have the true climate is related to some sort of model output at best choice of some parameters that are considered the best choice. And then there's a discrepancy term, which if it was zero, would be a perfect model. But of course, we don't have perfect models because we don't represent all the processes. And so what you do is you use the observations to basically work out the likelihood of any parameter combination being that best input. And so what you can do to make the probability projections, and so this is two different ways we use the observations. The first way is to basically sample parameter space, get the emulator, build a little Gaussian distribution, give it a likelihood weight, and accumulate all that to give you your probabilities. And on the right-hand side, it's more this history matching that Danny mentioned, which is about, so what I'm not showing you in this plot are all the different realizations which didn't pass muster because they didn't compare well with the observations. So we've ruled out a whole load of things here. And it's all based around this kind of implausibility metric, really. So this is a measure basically of the difference between the observations and the model data. And then, but of course, it's crucial to normalize that by all the kind of things that can cause uncertainty in the observations and the model data. So the two on the left relate to the observations. And so there's measurement error, but there's also what we call representation error, which encompasses the fact that in the model world, we have big grid boxes and we have all the data for all the time points. But in the real world, we might have site-specific data and it might only be for a part of the time window. So we could try to encapsulate that uncertainty. Also, the real world is one realization that could have happened, but it could have had other realizations of noise. And on the right-hand side, we have model noise term, but we also have this structural uncertainty as well. And so if we're filtering, basically we specify a threshold for this metric. And then if too many of the observables exceed this threshold, then we rule the model out. When we do the probabilistic predictions, we use this kind of e to the minus I squared as the kind of likelihood weight. So one crucial thing is not to use just one metric to constrain your probabilistic projections. What we want is actually a whole range of different measures. So we use actually mean climate. So this is precipitation, relative humidity, radiative fluxes here. We use all these grid boxes. And the reason we do that is because if you just use like a small number of metrics, then your chances of rewarding a poor model for the wrong reasons are quite high. We also use historical temperature trends as well. And then this is just to illustrate the importance of having those terms on the bottom, the implausibility metric. So for example, if we include a discrepancy term, and this applies to any of those terms, then you're adding a bigger number to that the bottom. And so you're dividing by a bigger number. And so you're getting a much more kind of spread out set of likelihood weights, which then lead to a much smoother distribution. If you don't include this term, the likelihood weights get lots more spiky because you're dividing by a smaller term. And so you end up with this kind of narrower, spikier PDF. So the whole point of doing this is to avoid kind of overconfident projections. And one of the big things I wanted to focus on, because we're comparing methods across fields, is that we really do exploit the fact that we have different climate modeling centers around the world running different climate models. And so I've already shown you with the plausible realizations that we pull our members with models from the IPCC. Normally we overlap more than that, and we do for some variables, but this time around we didn't so much with global warming. I'm not going to go into this too much detail, but this comes from a European climate projections project, and all A to E are all different methods for weighting. And what they've done is they've taken the fifth assessments report data and trained up their methods on that. So that was 2014 data. And then they've compared it with the recent assessment that was made last year, kind of doing an out of sample test. And if the measures are kind of in this bottom half here, then they tend to be overconfident. And you find that a lot of them are overconfident. The only difference are actually when you pool all those estimates together, then they start becoming underconfident. The final one here is the fact that we actually use the other models in our making our probabilistic projections. So what we do is we use our emulator and we hunt through our parameter space and try and find a best analog for each of these other models. And then we find this analog and then we use the emulator to predict it. And then we get an error. And then we pull those errors across the different models from the other centers and we come up with a kind of estimate for discrepancy term. It's not perfect because all the models have a common error. We don't pick that up, but it's better than nothing. So that's sort of whistle top through stop. I've gone right through kind of all the products there. But the key thing for me that I have concentrate on is the model imperfections and what happens with this structural term. And although we got a discrepancy term in there, it's valuable, but it's not a fix. And so if we want our climate projections to be not only kind of at least usable, but also actionable, then we need to understand when our way of doing it is limited. And basically, it's results from high resolution climate models and weather really do expose when we have limitations in that approach. But first of all, I want to show you something positive about having the discrepancy term in there. Again, from the European climate projections, these are these eight methods, A to E. The light orange are the priors, the dark orange is the posteriors. And you can see they constrain it differently. The one on the right is actually the probabilistic projections from UKCP 18. And you can see actually we have wider prior because we've got more data, but we also we tend to constrain it less because we've got a discrepancy term in. Actually, this one does too, and that one constrains less as well. But that's definitely the value of having that discrepancy term. But then he's a friend, but he's caused me problems. So he's a colleague, he comes along, and this is the kind of model we were running at UKCP 18, the 60 kilometer model. And he comes along with a model which is much higher resolution. And so this is UK winter precipitation changes. And here's one model, he gets much higher rainfall over the UK than anything we produced in our projections. So already we've got a new model is outside our range. And the reason is because the Gulf Stream actually, there's more ways to resolve the Gulf Stream. It's a better model for the Gulf Stream and it can react in different ways to climate change. And that's something we hadn't captured. And then the weather. So last year had a bit of a, probably the most eye-opening bit of weather I've seen in my lifetime, which was the heat dome over Canada, which was really, really hot. And in fact, Ben Sanderson here, who's writing a paper up on this at the moment, he's got this nice plot which shows the observed value for the heat dome. And he's compared it against all the kind of values you would get in all the years from all the different models from the sixth assessment. And you can see it's way outside. There's nothing that can capture that. And so then that starts thinking, well, maybe we haven't got the processes to capture that. And when you actually look into this, one of the plausible mechanisms for this is that there's kind of extratropical circulation patterns which set up these kind of blocking events. So these are big anticyclonic high pressure systems that kind of can then set up and sit there and just not move for weeks. And then they can build, but they also provide consistent kind of weather. And when you look at why that happens, then one of the hypotheses is that it's coming from convection events in the tropics. So this is organized convection in the tropics, and it's kind of very small scale, and it needs really high resolution to capture it, and it's way higher resolution than we've actually got in our climate models. So can we, is this another, are we ever going to be able to get this in the climate models at the resolution we're running at? So potential ways forward. So I've alluded to, in fact, I think the key is to understand the processes that are going on and to recognize when the processes that are happening in the real world are not being captured in our models. And then I think there are two ways forward for exposing this through better kind of metrics, but also then doing something about it. So having some runs at either higher resolution, or we can improve the model to get better scale-aware parameterization schemes. We can run more imaginative experiments. And there's also bias correction. So I'll go through some of those. So in the latest sixth assessment report, we had something new, which was that there was a big community effort to kind of constrain what we call a key kind of metric of, which is the equilibrium climate sensitivity. So this is when you double CO2 and run to equilibrium, this is the amount of global warming you get. Different models have different amounts of this, so it's a key thing to kind of narrow down. And so what they did was they focused on three different ways of constraining this, and then they combined these different bits of evidence. So there were process-based metrics, historical temperature trends, and paleoclimate evidence. And just focusing on the process metrics, what they did was then they dug down into the key processes, which tend to be all around clouds. And they came up with these different seven different cloud feedbacks and put actually, they used high resolution models to kind of constrain these and provide distributions. And eventually all this stuff was put together and came up with this black line here for equilibrium climate sensitivity. But the key here is there was lots of process-based evaluation. Then there's a colleague of mine, Yoko Tsushima, who wrote a paper where she's actually used our perturbed parameter ensemble, and she's looked at clouds in zonal averages. So this is when you average across all the longitudes for each different latitude band. So there's latitude across here. And then she's done a parameter sensitivity analysis. So basically the different colors are different parameters. And this is the fraction of variance explained by each of those parameters. And you can see in the tropics, what you're doing is you're getting lots of convection of type related parameters dominating. Whereas in the extratropics, you're getting cloud ice parameters and also parameters that affect what happens at the top of the clouds. But you can see there are generally a lot. For the different cloud types, there's lots of different parameters contributing, and that makes it hard to calibrate. So what she then did was then she focused on the fact that different cloud regimes exist around the world. So, for example, on the west coast of the continents, you get stratocumulus decks. So that's a special type of cloud structure. You get different ones, fluffier clouds out into the ocean. And then she would like, on these cloud regimes, she would do separate analyses. So on the stratocumulus decks, you can see it's isolating kind of a parameter that actually affects how bright the cloud is. Whereas in the deep convective zones in the tropics, you're getting it's dominated by convection. Okay, thank you. So by having targeted metrics, she's getting more focus on particular parameters, which will help expose structural errors. Okay, so weighting is becoming very popular now in the sixth assessment, and people now want to use historical temperature trend weighting just to weight the models, and that's it, which isn't great. It's certainly not great for me because it weights down all these models up here, and all these orange runs up here are in that zone. So is that the right thing to do? And I'm not sure it is, because if you look at this other work from the European project, this is models where they look at just the climate mean performance, and that measures the processes. Whereas this is including information from the historical trend. So if we've got great processes in our model, and there's even better models out there, but actually, if you use just the historical temperature trend, or you want to use that, you can upweight models which don't have very good processes because they're right over to the left here. And it would mean that my friend's lovely high resolution model run would be downweighted and to zero, even though there's valuable information in there. So is there a way of actually combining the best bits of each model? And that's something I think we need to work on. And just to say that the implausibility metric also has you could have a bias correction term in here on the discrepancy. So that might be one way of factoring that in. So I'm going to skip this slide because I can summarize it. But the general gist is that I think there's not just one sweet spot in how to use your supercomputing complexity, ensemble size or resolution. I think basically you need to do several things. You need to keep doing increasing the ensemble size and exploring the uncertainty, but you're going to have to do something in the resolution, sort of have experiments which target those places where your models are limited and where your discrepancy isn't working so well, and you need more than one experiment. And I think that's something that I think could apply to other fields, not just climate. So in the interest of time, getting questions, I will stop right there. Thanks.
Any questions? Oh, it's Jane.
I'm Jane Hutton, University of Warwick. I like your first point because this isn't an area I've studied much, but looking at your projections, which I think you had about three slides back, one further. Yeah, that one on the right-hand side. in anything that looked like that to me, where you're projecting forward something that is so completely different from what's in the past, I would want to see a very test the driver of that phase change, because that's clearly a major phase change. But these climate models have been around for a while. I don't know how many years. So how good are they if you go back to the ones that were reported 20 years ago and look at what's actually happened?
So that's a good
question.
How do
they compare? And also, what's the consistency of the data collection on things like temperature? I remember seeing something and I just asked a basic question. It was about Central Park, New York. I said, when were the measuring devices changed? And the guy just looked at me blankly.
So I'll do that second one first of all. So yes, I think the different instruments, there are a whole bunch of people, there's a community out there, the metrologists, who try to make measurements as how we take measurements and the metadata around that, make it kind of as consistent as possible and calibrate instruments as well as possible. And a lot of the instrumentation, I mean, we have data sets that go back to 1850, 1780, things like coming off ships that traveled around kind of in the Victorian times. And there's a whole community there working on trying to remove biases, because they realize there are biases in the way that the profile of the instrumentation changed over time. So like buckets coming out of the ships and would evaporate the water by the time they put it on deck, and what that bucket was made from. And there was a whole field of people working on that, whether you have more ships, like going around World War II in the Pacific, were mainly suddenly, you know, big military vessels, those kind of things. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on trying to uniformize all those sort of things. I can't speak for like the New York record, but ideally you do have a lot of metadata. And there's a whole community, that massive community, that works on that kind of thing. It's not perfect, but they do put a lot of error bars around there these days. And you just don't get one time series, you get realizations. So that's much nicer for people like me. In terms of the climate models, yes, they have evolved over 20 years. It's really interesting in the sixth assessment report. It's really an eye-opener that suddenly a lot more of the sophisticated models are finding themselves up here. Like this model, and there are different reasons for different models. Our model, we think it's because the clouds in the mid-latitudes, so the kind of the storm tracks and things like that, are responding too much to climate change than they do in the real world. And it could be just that one thing that's enough to move them from here. It could have moved, if we bias corrected that and scaled it, and that is possible, we could move it down into this territory quite easily. In terms of the processes, I mean, my point here was actually, you know, there are some models, these have got pretty good processes in there. So capturing the right kind of the storms, the dynamics in our model is very good. But there are a lot of models out there still that are trying to tune up to the global temperature. And so I was surprised they do quite a good job, but they haven't got the processes in there. So do you trust it in the future? So I think it's quite nuanced how you use that information. And we can't give that just to a user to sort out. We have to kind of understand that ourselves. But I think process evaluation is the way forward to understand things like those mid-latitude clouds. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
I'm going to ask one quick question then while we make sure the second next speaker is on course. Do you think that we need to worry about the kind of models that we're combining? So we've talked about kind of looking at model ensembles, and you touched on it a little bit, but if you're combining too many really complicated models with not enough of the ones that get the bigger kind of constructs, do we need to worry about that? Do we need to plan carefully which models we combine and which we don't?
So that's the kind of what we used to call model democracy, all models get equal weight, was something that was happening in the fifth assessment report. And it's this kind of work now where people are kind of now thinking about weighting. Whereas actually in UK CPO9, we were doing this in our probabilistic projections. The models we've got in the sixth assessment report are much better. Generally, they perform better than the fifth assessment report. There are definitely the more that we have two problems. The more recent models that are kind of new haven't developed so much, and actually they then tune to things that people know they need to match to, so they look good, but they won't capture a lot of the processes. some of the reasons we've gone to high climate sensitivity is because now we get more interactions between aerosols and the clouds in our model. It's more sophisticated, but I don't think we understand it as well as we need to understand it. And that could be one reason why the clouds are responding too strongly. So we do have to be careful. I think the other problem, is a lot of people who are kind of new modelers are inheriting code from the other models. So actually there's a big whole model interdependence issue going on. And Ben Sanderson, I mentioned, kind of has a measure that kind of measures that interdependence. And so there you've got to be quite careful that you don't kind of count the same model. I mean, the Met Office model is actually, the code is used in, I think, two or three other models. So people are wise to that, and they take account of that. But yeah, you have to be very careful. And I think until you understand, that's why I like the processed evaluation, because you're really getting at what actually the processes that are changing the climate. The kind of mean climate stuff is very kind of blurred out, and it's a bit blunt instrument to actually constrain the parameters. So you end up with diversity and spread, but you haven't really calibrated it and really understood where your kind of structural errors are. So, but you have to be careful.
Thank you. We thank our speaker again, and I'll see you. So our next speaker is Richard Clayton, who I hope will miraculously appear on the screen.
Oh.
Are you there?
I'm here and ready to.